Okay, there we go. All right, we're going to start looking at the wisdom literature. A lot of what we have been covering is historical or prophetical. The Bible, before the Christian age, the Old Testament was divided up into three segments. The law, which is the Torah, the prophets, and however you want to pronounce that word, you can, and the writings. And I can't pronounce that one either. But it was divided up into the three sections. And so what we're going to start looking at today is the writings, the wisdom books. The wisdom books, first thing we want to know when we're looking at the wisdom books is that they are written in poetry. So we're not reading historical timelines, but we're reading poetry. I don't know about you, but poetry was not my favorite subject in school. But you want to know that they're different, and so they're not historically oriented. You can't, except in some of them, you can't even put the date as to when they were written because they're outside any historical context. They deal with universal concerns which are not necessarily, didn't happen in this day or that day. And so when you start reading the commentaries and different things, you'll find all sorts of dates for the wisdom literature. We'll look at the book of Job as an example. You know, some people date the book of Job before Abraham, and some people date the book of Job around Malachi, so it's a huge stretch. I think they're wrong when they go that far in, but because it doesn't say, then one guess is probably good as another. And sometimes we don't need to worry. Sometimes we worry about stuff we don't need to worry about. It doesn't really matter when it was written. And oftentimes in these wisdom literatures, it's the writers are speaking for man to God versus the prophets, which is God speaking to man. So sometimes it's more man expressing his views towards God. Okay? The wisdom, why do they call it wisdom literature? I had to look that up because I don't know. Because it deals with basic issues of life so that you can live within society and within God's moral structure. And it brings out the point that God rules the world with an extra O in Theo. That should not be Theo, it should be the. God rules the world, and a right relationship with Him produces wisdom. The wisdom books are not directed related to the covenant, but more how God rules the whole world. So there's a lot. There's be things in there. It doesn't say about law or things like that, but it does talk about making sure you have a right relationship with God. Let's see. I didn't mention that the cultural settings of the book is a lot more important than historical context. When you understand the culture that's going on at the time, because there'll be phrases and things mentioned that it doesn't matter where it was historically, but it does matter culturally. You know, for example, "The Lord is my shepherd" means a lot more to a shepherding culture than cattle herding culture. the famous sheep in cattle wars. "The Lord is my shepherd" is not a great concept for a cattleman. But so if you understand it in the culture that it's in, then it makes a lot more sense. A lot of times, what we'll do, what we see as we read these. Wisdom literature is that it's poetry, so it has to be poetic. So how is it poetic? And what it uses is poetic parallelism. You know, when I say the word poem, I automatically think of things that rhyme. Yeah. Because that's the only kind of poetry I know. You know, "I never saw a purple cow" type poetry. That's, you know. You know, I never saw a purple cow. I never hope to see one, but I can tell you anyhow, I'd rather see than be one. You know, that to me, that's good poetry right there. You know, roses are red, violets are blue. You know, I think of poetry in that kind of setting. But this is Hebrew poetry, and so it uses what's called parallelism, and there's different types of parallelism. And once you grasp some of this, then when you read it, it makes the reading kind of cool. Because you go, oh, that's cool. Now, a big thing, and we'll have to see this as we go through some of it, you're reading Hebrew poetry in English. So there's going to be some things that are lost in translation. And so we'll name some of these things, and you'll go, well, I don't see that. Well, it's because you're not reading Hebrew. If you're reading the Hebrew, you'd go, oh, that's cool. But because sometimes a lot of the things, even the things like the parallelism, doesn't quite translate as clearly in English as it did in Hebrew. But here's an example. There's synonymous parallelism. That's where the first line is repeated in the next line. They're parallel. They say the same thing. For example, Psalms 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of God, line 1. The skies proclaim the works of His hands. It says the same thing, both lines. And so, oftentimes it's not a matter of rhyming in words, but rhyming in thought. The thoughts are the same. So in a lot of Psalms, Proverbs, even Job, you'll find a lot of parallelism in that. Also in Ecclesiastes. Okay. There's another type of parallelism called chiastic parallelism. And that's where the same idea is represented, but it's in opposite order. You know, it goes from A to Z in this line, then it goes to Z to A in the next line. So Psalm 51:1 says, "Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions." You see, both, they started and ended with the same thought. So he went one way and then came back the other. That's chiastic parallelism. And when I first was reviewing all this stuff and studying, and I thought, do we really want to know all that? But as you get into it and as you start seeing it, then it starts making the reading, as you're reading it, it helps you get the whole idea. This is poetry and it's kind of cool. And then you even see a bigger picture of what's being portrayed. Antithetic parallelism is when the second line is opposite of the first. Psalm 1:6, "The Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction." So one line he's talking about the righteous, the next line he's talking about the wicked.
Mark?
Yes, sir?
Do some of the translations do a better job of retaining the structure than others? Or...
Probably so, but I wouldn't know which one would be more.
I think the King James is kind of known for that.
Yeah, well, King James is a more poetic language in the first place, I think. Yeah. Yeah, I was reading, and there were some examples in what I was reading, and I went and looked at, and it didn't say that in the translation I was reading. So I had a hard time. I had to try to pick examples that were clear to me. And probably so. If you read different translations, it might make more sense. Then there's a synthetic or constructive parallelism. It's where the second line completes the first line, or there's a comparison, or it builds to a climax. In Psalm, well, let's go ahead and look at these. Psalms 2, verse 6. Well, these are sometimes hard to see. I've installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. So the second line, on Zion, my holy hill, what did he do? Well, that's where he installed the king. So the second line completed the first line. Proverbs 15:7, where there's a comparison. "The lips of the wise spread knowledge, not so the hearts of fools." So there's a comparison between the two, and he's comparing their lips. The wise spread knowledge, but not so hearts of the fool. And then if you read Psalms 1, the different lines build to a climax. Blessed is a man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. So you're going to see a building. He doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. So there's a building up towards a climax. Okay? A lot of times, though, like I said, things get lost in translation. In the Hebrew poetry, some of the things you won't see so much in English is there's alliteration where they use of similar sounds. Well, that doesn't translate into English because, and I found, you know, when you teach in another culture and you say something that sounds really cool, it doesn't translate so cool to the next guy. That's happened to me many times when I would have been translated into Spanish. I found out that some of the words I use in English that sounded really neat didn't make any sense in Spanish. So sometimes the use of alliteration, the use of similar sounds doesn't always work. Then there's a paronomasio or something like that. It's a play on sound or meaning of words. I think also that even shows up sometimes in the Minor Prophets where they'll use a word that's like the city Beth-El. He used another word, Beth something else. I forgot what it was now. But they sounded similar, but they meant kind of opposite. Instead of being the place of God, it was the place of sin. And so it's kind of a play on words. That's maybe the closest we see in English. Then there's also acrostic structure where every line begins with the letter of the alphabet. But it's the Hebrew alphabet, not the English alphabet. Psalms 119 is that way. The virtuous woman, Proverbs 31:10-31, is an acrostic poem. So it's kind of cool. But it doesn't translate in English that way. Oftentimes there's terseness. They use, it's kind of a compact language. They use no more than three or four words to describe something. And so it's these little compact phrases, and then not always in English does it translate that way for us. And then also there's the great use of imagery, and which does, like the Lord is my shepherd, produces a great image. Okay?
The Lord is my rancher.
The Lord is my rancher, for those of us from Texas. One of the problems we have sometimes with Scripture and in trying to learn things, and we say things literally. Well, if like we're going to make a point, we'll say, well, literally the Bible says. But that's not good because we don't want to. That doesn't prove you. It actually doesn't. It proves you don't know what you're talking about. I used to say that all the time. In fact, Molly's son Lee Red is a scholar in Greek, and he would always get on to me because I would say, "Well, literally the Greek says," and then he would pull me aside and say, "You can't say that because literally it doesn't make sense. If the Bible was literal, we just need to do what the Bible literally says." Then God has feathers, Psalms 91 verse 4. Genesis 41 verse 57 says, all the countries came to Egypt to collect grain. Does that mean the American Indians got in a boat and went to...
No, canoe.
Or a canoe and paddled to Egypt to get grain? So literally, not all the countries, but that, sometimes we do that. And then in Job 41... That should be 8 through 21. Leviathan is a fire-breathing dragon because it describes what the Leviathan looked like and everything else. So if it's literal, then he was a fire-breathing dragon, which maybe he was just a crocodile. I don't know. Okay. So that kind of gives us the setting for the wisdom literature overall. And I kind of wanted to do that because as we get then into the actual books, then we have this kind of background. We're looking at things that's poetic. We'll see a lot of parallelism. And that helps us to kind of grasp what it is that it's talking about. All right, so when we read the book of Job, and that's what we're going to talk a little bit now. Job could be called in its style more like an epic poem. In writings, the epic poems would be like Homer's Iliad, John Milton's Paradise Lost. What was the other one I had written down? Beowulf. Now, those are considered epic poems, and so it's all about it's a poem that tells a story, and it's about a hero. Well, Job is that kind of poetry, in that it's a kind of this epic, long epic poem, and it's about the hero, and the hero happens to be Job. But Job, like I said, the poetic books, the wisdom literature, bring up universal questions and tries to help us to grasp things. The book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes are almost opposite. You know, Ecclesiastes describes God's interaction with man as pretty much man does whatever he wants and the best he can do is have fun while he's here. Where Job contrasts that with, we got to hang on to God no matter what happens. And so they're almost opposite, but it's that universal problem. And Job asked the question about God: is He just or unjust? And that's kind of the idea. That's, if you want to memorize the book of Job, you can memorize this picture, because you things might be bad, but you're still in the hands of God. Yeah. The key term in the book of Job is suffering. You know, it's speculative wisdom. It's that it's looking at whether or not, why are we here and what's the point? You know, we struggle, we have problems, and the key verse in the book of Job is Job 1:21. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. That's kind of where Job starts. He hangs on to God. He goes through a whole period of wishing he wasn't ever born. Because life is really, really hard, and he feels like he's being treated unjustly, and God's not fair. And then he closes the book with coming back and hanging on to God. There's some examples of parallelism in the book of Job. It's parallel in thought, not in rhyme. There is the synonymous parallelism. And as you read through it, you'll begin to see some of these things, that it is poetry, it's not historical. And so there's debate on, was this an actual person, actual events, because people don't normally talk like this, or is it a rewriting of what actually happened into a poem? I believe that there are proofs within the Bible, and we'll get to those later, that Job was a real person, but how it was written, whether it was written as a historical narrative or was it written as a poetry, doesn't really matter. It still happened. Okay? So I think sometimes we can get hung up on little things like that. And if the Bible doesn't tell you, then you don't know. That has to sink into my head, because I get caught up in what I think, and if it doesn't say, then you don't know. And no matter how many scholars argue back and forth about it, that's their best guess, but it's still their guess. Because unless the Bible specifically tells us, that's why, you know, when we do things like, well, we've never seen this place or that guy's name or whatever, well, wait. Eventually they'll dig it up and we'll know. And so we have to let God be right and go from there. Job 5 verse 10. He bestows rain on the earth, line 1. He sends water upon the countryside, line two. They're parallel. So that you can pick up the parallelism as you read through the book, and that it kind of gives it a different flavor when you understand I'm reading a poem here, I'm not reading a story. Now, I might be reading a story, but it's written in the form of a poem. You understand? Then there's the antithetic, 10 verse 3. Does it please you to oppress me, to spurn the work of your hands, while you smile on the schemes of the wicked? So here's these two opposite thoughts. You know, on one hand, you're picking on me, and on the other hand, you're blessing the bad guys. So he gives that. And then the synthetic in 31 and verse 15. Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both from within our mothers? So you see the parallelism in there. All right? So I just throw those out as examples. What you can do then as you read through it for yourself. Pardon? Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to ask you a question, but I see we're still in Job.
Well, we're still in Job.
I just was wondering, because I've heard people use Job and they'll pull out verses and read it. But then at the end, God says, well, these guys didn't speak of me what's true.
Right.
So if you go back and you see, well, these people are pulling out verses from the people that Jesus said didn't speak of me as true, then it's like, I don't know what to do with all those verses.
Right. I'll address that in a minute.
Okay.
The point is, Job, the Bible has things in it that's not true.
That's
well. And Job is an example. There are things in there that aren't right. And that's the big discussion in the book of Job. And one of the major lessons to learn from the book of Job is that just because you have three friends that tell you this is what God says, doesn't mean this is what God says. And that's one of the major lessons for us, because sometimes we can be one of the three friends. And we think we know what God says, and then God will tell us, no, you are wrong. So I found the simplest outline I could find for Job. As this is how it's written. It's written, first of all, in a narrative prologue, chapters 1 and 2. Then it has these long poetic dialogue and monologues. That's when all the guys do their speeches. And the three friends, they each give, I think, two speeches. And Job gives his rebuttals and everything, chapters 3 through 41. And then the epilogue. Chapter 42. Another outline I found that was kind of easy to remember is Job's distress, chapters 1 through 3, Job's defense, chapters 4 through 37, and Job's deliverance, chapters 38 to 42. That gives us a breakdown of how the book works. I have a very long outline in the notes, but we don't need that.
The fourth speaker was a little more on key, though, wasn't it?
The fourth speaker?
There's three plus one. The youngest one.
The youngest one?
Yeah.
Well, we'll keep... Let's... And the key term in Job is suffering. Because the book of Job explores the issues of suffering despite God's goodness and power. And it's the question of why people suffer and evils continue that has been the focus of intense thought through the ages. In fact, John Oakes has written a book on the problem of pain and suffering. Yeah, I assume you used Job in the book.
I don't remember writing that book.
You didn't write that book?
No.
You did a class on it.
I have a DVD.
I know I've seen it with your name on it. Okay. So when he writes the book, he'll use it a lot. He'll be using a lot of Job from it. It's just a matter of time. I just thought I'd prophesy that out there. Here's a one-sentence summary of the book of Job. After the upright Job suddenly lost his family, health, and possessions, he and his friends dialogued at length about the reasons for his sufferings, but God alone had the final word and ultimately restored Job's losses. A one-sentence summary of the 42 chapters. I thought that kind of says what the book's all about and keeps us in focus. Because as you read it, you can get lost in the dialogues and what's going on, because these guys are saying all this stuff, and a lot of what they say sounds really good. And then we have to understand that that's not the whole story. We need the Paul Harvey rest of the story. Okay. The name Job, there's debate on what the actual name means. One idea is that the name Job is, where is the Father? Or where is God? Where's the Father? And the other one is the hated one. I don't know. That's kind of harsh, right? but that's the date as to when it happened is debatable. Some try to put it in like 2000 BC, and sometimes other people put it way earlier. I think that the book of Job falls in the patriarchal age because of some of the internal evidence that you can read from it. You may have a different opinion, and that's okay. Because here's why I would say it falls in the patriarchal period. Because Job performed his own sacrifices. There wasn't a Levitical priesthood that he went to. He had a personal relationship with God, and he offered his own sacrifices. That fits into the patriarchal period of Noah and Abraham, things like that. His wealth is measured in herds, but that was also true all the way through up to Malachi. So that's not conclusive, but it does fit. And there were roving tribes in the community, in the area, so it's not quite as organized, or it doesn't seem to be quite as organized into nations and things like that as it is later. And he lives for 140 years, which is consistent with the patriarchs. And the further you go in history, the shorter the lifespan. So for those reasons, I would think that it's probably in the patriarchal time period. Other people think it differently. And since it doesn't say, then we don't know. Okay? But that's my speculation. Is it fictitious or real? In Ezekiel chapter 14, verses 14 and 20, and in James chapter 5, verse 11, both reference Job as a real person. So the Bible tells me that Job was a real person, so I'm going to believe that Job is a real person. It's not just a made-up story. It's not just fictitious. So let's look a little bit about Job. Let's turn to Job chapter 1. Do I have 8 minutes?
Sure.
I mean, is that our correct? We're supposed to end in 8 minutes. There we go. Keep stalling. All right. Let's talk about Job and what he's like. Job chapter 1 and verse 1. In the land of Uz, there was a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. So his character, it talks about Job's character is that he was blameless. That's a word, T-A-M, is Hebrew English transliteration of the Hebrew word, meaning he was whole and complete. It doesn't mean he was faultless or without sin, but it's also used of Noah. Same word describes Noah. His wife said that he was that he was blameless, and Job said he was blameless. So, and also he was upright, which is Yashar. Which means he did not deviate from God's standard. So if he's blameless and upright, then he's right at the peak of moral. He's a pretty good guy. Okay? Then it says that he feared God. He reverenced his Creator and was humbly submitted to his will. The ancients viewed the fear of God as a foundation of wisdom as well as its goal. Now, Oswald Chambers says, the remarkable thing about fearing God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else. So, if you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else. So Job is this great guy. But then everything bad happens. This is like a country song. He lost it all.
You're cheating hard.
Yeah. You know when you play a country song backwards? You get your house back, your kids back, your car back. But Job, all of a sudden everything falls apart. He loses it all. He loses his family. He loses his wealth. He loses his possessions. He loses his health. And three friends come running to the rescue. They come to restore him. He's trying to figure out, okay, is God just or unjust? Job's three friends come to comfort and restore him. After an initial period of mourning and silence, so when they get with him, first thing they do is nothing, which is great. They start off really great.
That's the thing they do.
They sit there and keep their mouths shut was the best thing they did the whole time they were there. But then they began their speeches, their firm but mistaken convictions about why Job is suffering. They have wrong theology. They claim that all suffering is a result of sin and prosperity is the result of virtues. Be careful not to believe this. It's so easy to think that because I am so blessed, it is because I am so good. And others are suffering because they are so bad. We tend to like to believe that the consequences of sin are immediate and evident. But that's not always true. But we tend to believe that. And I think sometimes we can be the three friends of jumping in and trying to explain to someone why they're going through something in their life based on that same theology. If you would just live a better life as a Christian, you wouldn't be having these problems. Wow. But Job was upright, God-fearing, and he was sitting on the ash heap. So we have to be careful of that. Eliphaz knew that God judged the wicked, therefore Job must be guilty. Okay? Bildad, if you repent, God will restore you. And he uses an image, you're a plant without water. If you would just straighten up, God would take care of you. Zophar was caustic and unsympathetic. How dare you boast about your innocence? I'm moving quickly here because I'm just going to kind of go through the slides. The heart of Job's case was that God did not always bless the righteous and judge the wicked as his friends claimed. No many wicked people were happy and prosperous. You read chapter 21, 7 through 34, chapter 24, 1 through 17. And what Job was asking, I need an explanation. I reject what you guys are saying because it's not true. And even though, and this is, I believe this is the lesson for us because we can get so caught up in our ideas of what true righteousness and relationship with God and being a good disciple, all those things, what we think they mean, and then we go in and we try to apply it to someone else and their circumstance, and we can be off base. We need to be careful. Then, what happens in the end of the book is God speaks. After all these guys did all their talking, beginning in chapter 38 through 42, is the second longest speech in the Bible from God, the first being the giving of the law. So here God steps in. Everyone's got shared their equal opinion, and it was wrong. And so then God speaks. And it's really interesting the way God deals with Job. Job's asking all these questions. It's not fair. It's not right. Why is this happening to me? And God does not answer any of his questions. Instead, he asks Job questions. In fact, he asks him about 70 questions. And he gets to Job and he says, "Okay, you got some questions for me? I got some questions for you." You think you got? Let me ask you some questions, and it's great. And in fact, if you want to grow in your appreciation for God, read chapters 38 to 42 every day for a month. Because we got questions too, right? We got issues, we got problems, and we got questions, and we walk around going, "God, how come? And why not? And this is happening, and that's happening, and I don't get it, and I don't understand, and I deserve an answer." We kind of feel that way. And then when God speaks, he says, okay, I love it. Brace yourself like a man. 38 verse 3. "Brace yourself like a man and I will question you and you will answer me." He sets Job down and straightens him out. Now here's the guy who's lost everything. He's lost his health, his wealth, his children. And God doesn't let him off because it's hard. And sometimes we want to be let off because it's hard. Because we've had bad things happen, and if I wasn't being recorded, I'd say life sucks. But, you know, I am being recorded, and I did say it on record. So I should have covered the mic or something. But sometimes that's how we feel. And it's amazing that God did not let Job off because it was hard. In fact, he goes, "Okay, let me ask you some questions. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Who marked off its dimension? Who stretches the measuring line?" You know, he just hits him over and over and over. And Cindy read this book, great book, "When People Are Big and God Is Small." And it actually gives a challenge. Read 38 to 42 every day for a month and get your... See, we fear people and not God. We're more concerned what people think than what God thinks. If we had turned that around and we were more concerned about what God thinks and we had fear of God, then people wouldn't be such an issue for us. And that's what Job does here, and he gets after Job. And then so Job has to end chapter 42. "Then Job replied to the Lord, 'I know that you do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you and you will answer me. Verse 5, my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you.'" You see, Job's whole perception changed. Sometimes in our quest for knowledge, we get things twisted. And we hear about God and we think we know. But what if we actually had to deal with Him face to face? There was one of the quotes I read, the guy said, I had millions of questions I wanted to ask God. And when I saw Him, I couldn't remember any of them. So, you know, that would probably be our case, right? We're going a little over. Here's some theological significance of Job. God may allow people to be tested so that they can demonstrate their dedication to God and His will for their lives. It is an error to conclude that all sickness and trouble come because of sin. Sometimes the innocent suffer, and the wicked are not immediately judged. Since people on earth cannot see the whole picture and have a very limited understanding of God's plans and wise purposes, they should not question God's justice. Comforting the sufferer is not achieved by naive accusations, but identifying with their grief and praying for God's mercy.
Amen.
Sometimes we need to shut up.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's theological. The danger of religious knowledge. I read this last week and I swear we're going to close. Religion gives people the notion that they have God under control. Religion says that we can understand God absolutely and completely. We can predict what the Almighty will do tomorrow. The Christian religion teaches that the Bible answers virtually every question that's brought to the sacred text. The problem with this line of thought is that the true God cannot fit into anyone's box. God will always end up breaking out of our human expectations and understanding. Every attempt to capture God and cram and ram Him in a system will ultimately fail. The true God is an untamed lion. He cannot be controlled. The true God is the controller. So, our time's up on that. So, the book of Job is we have to let God be God and keep our opinions to ourselves. and let God be in control. He'll show Himself. And then, that's Ecclesiastes.
I know.
Oh, actually, two slides got stuck into each other. That's Ecclesiastes and Psalms. Ecclesiastes actually is just the word. It doesn't have any. Ecclesiastes is a separate slide. It just has the word with nothing, because that's the message of Ecclesiastes. And then you got Psalm tree singing there, and that's Psalms. Okay, so great. Good to be with you guys. Next week, we will finish out the wisdom literature. We'll look at Psalms and Proverbs. And we'll catch more of this poetic stuff. And I think it'll be great. Okay? Thank you. We can do about 1 second.